The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you for coming. Thank you very much. Just want to make sure we have a nice screen here. Well, thanks. God, you know, there's so much drama during the day nowadays that I think you'd all be excused if you didn't want any more at night. But anyway, thank you. Thank you for coming. You know, I thought what I would do is I've got some really wonderful photographs, some of which are in the book, but I just usually, wherever I traveled, I had a photographer with me, and so basically every photograph I'm going to show you is kind of a scene in the book anyway, and I thought I'd kind of walk you through some of it, and it kind of takes you through the book, kind of the arc of the book, and then, you know, I'll stop a couple places, and I'll read, and I'll do that for a while, and then maybe if you all wanted to ask some questions or something, we could do that. I've just come from Iraq a few weeks ago. And before that, I was actually in Pakistan, so I've on the Afghan border. So I was sort of making a tour of the world's vacation spots before I started before my book came out. But I'll do that, and then, you know, we'll kind of throw it open and ask me some questions if you want. But, you know, I hope my book is a little different than some of the others. There's been a lot of books on Iraq and Afghanistan, a lot of very good ones. And I think most of them are sort of written from 10,000 feet up, a kind of bird's eye view, you know, what happened in Washington, the overall direction of the war. You know, this book opens in September 1998 at the Kabul Sports Stadium 10 years ago. Thank you very much. 10 years ago. And I've just by kind of luck and chance and opportunity, I've seen an extraordinary number of things kind of up close. And so I wanted to do a kind of, I didn't really want to make an argument. I didn't want to really write an intellectual book as much as I wanted to write an emotional book and a kind of visceral book. And I wanted to kind of take people along with me and kind of show them what I saw and have them feel what I felt, because I've seen a lot of things. And so let me just get going, and then I'll kind of talk about it. As if anyone here needs a map of Afghanistan. I don't even know why I put that. I think this was for like a third grade class at some point. But I just want to say, when you drop into Afghanistan for the first time, it's just an amazing place. And, you know, it's a place of war and strife and suffering and all that. But really, if you could all sort of, usually you kind of land in an old broken down helicopter. If you could all sort of get off, James Hill, who took most of the photographs that you're going to see, he's a good friend of mine and photographer. We were just driving down the road one day. And this is really, really what it looks like. It's just an amazing place. You go to these villages that don't have electricity. They don't have running water. They haven't even seen the wheel yet in some of them. It's like the 4th century. And it's just amazing. This is just a scene from northern Afghanistan. And I should say, as I think I mentioned, the opening scene of the book, or the opening chapter of the book, is I was in the Kabul Sports Stadium on a Friday afternoon almost 10 years ago to the day. I went there for a public execution and an amputation, being performed by these kind of strange, funny-looking men that nobody had much heard about called the Taliban. And, of course, it was 3 years before 9/11. I didn't know what to think of them. I didn't know much about them. And it was an incredible thing. And you know, looking back now, of course, you know, it was all very, very clear. But back then, it was a very confusing time. Who are these people? You know, and it was... This is a nice scene. This is actually a donkey parking lot. And that was sort of, you know, tended to by Father Time, as you can see. But it was like 2 cents to park your donkey. These are just wonderful shots. So this is kind of a typical village, actually, in northern Afghanistan, believe it or not. You know, everything here is kind of the 4th century, of course, except for his weaponry, which is kind of sums up the place. You can see it hasn't rained in about 1,000 years. This is, you know, Afghanistan is just it's like a place out of the Bible, and really it's sort of a place of, you know, plagues and famines and locusts, and in this case, earthquakes. And this is actually a ravine that had opened up from an earthquake a couple of years before. And so it was about 100 feet or 150 feet across, and we were just, James and I were sort of standing there one day, and here's a pilgrimage of women kind of walking to nowhere. But just look at the scenery. It's just astonishing. Here's another village. I'm sorry. Occasionally. Let's see. I think this photo actually ran in National Geographic. I don't know how many of you remember. You know, James Hill and I, you'll see, we spent so much time together. We were practically husband and wife. He's married with two children. But this is actually a very nice photo. I don't know if you can see, but this is a camera, an old-style camera. And that's the man here is the photographer, and that's him in the little photo when he was a young man. And as you can see, you know, wherever I go, I look like a CIA agent in that part of the world. And so I tend to draw a crowd. And you can see everybody kind of crowded around here. And most of these pictures, again, are from, they're from before 9/11 in Afghanistan, this kind of forgotten place. If you remember, the Soviet Union had been there, invaded in 1979, had more or less destroyed the country, left in 1989. And everybody kind of left in 1989. I mean, the Americans and the Saudis had helped the rebels. They flooded the place with guns. And everybody kind of left. And it was this forgotten place, and it kind of imploded in this terrible civil war. And, you know, for me, and I'm going to come to a photo in a second. This is actually downtown Kabul. This is the main shopping street. It's called Jaidi Maiwand. This is actually how I found it in September 1998. And this is sort of, you know, there's been so much written on 9/11 and why it happened and how it happened. For me, this is all I need. You know, this was basically what happened to the society. It just kind of imploded in this horrible civil war. This was Kabul. And in 1992, I remember one of the Afghans telling me, he said, you know, in 1992, and again, this is 4 years before the Taliban came to power, 3 years after the Soviet Union left, he said, you know, there were 41 different militias fighting for control of Kabul. You know, you couldn't, just to drive from one end of the city to the other, you had to pay bribes. Maybe your daughter would be raped. Maybe your son would be raped. Out of this came the Taliban. And basically in the beginning, you know, not now, not by 2001, but in the beginning they were sort of very righteous kind of country boys. And they put an end to this. You know, they were the law and order boys. And so that day in the, and I'll read you a little bit here. That day in the Kabul Sports Stadium, when they were putting this man to death, I think for allegedly murdering somebody else, they were reading into the Quran and they were saying, in revenge there is life, in revenge there is life, which is, you know, a pretty chilling phrase. But then I remember he sort of departed at one point, whoever it was, the mullah who was reading, and he said, we have to do this, we have to do this, you know, if we don't do this, the anarchy will return. And I think people understood that. You know, there was a certain amount of sympathy for the Taliban then. So why don't I just, with that, I'm just going to read you a couple of paragraphs. It's very short. It's kind of from that time. You can just sort of, well, I think it's just an illumination of what's in the photograph. In the late afternoons, the center of Kabul had an empty twilight feel, a quiet that promised nothing more than another day like itself. There were hardly any cars then, just some old women floating silently in their head-to-toe burqas. Old meat hung in the stalls, buildings listed in the ruins. One of those afternoons, a thin little shoeshine boy walked up to me. He was smiling and running his finger across his throat. "Mother is no more," he said, finger across the neck. "Father is finished." His name was Nasir, and he repeated the phrase in German and in French, smiling as he did. "Mutter ist nicht mehr. Vater ist fertig." He dragged his finger across his throat again. "Rockets," he said. "Rocketen." His pale green eyes were rimmed in black. He did not ask for money. He wanted to clean my boots. Then he was gone, scampering down the muddy street with his tiny wooden box. Kabul was full of orphans like Nasir, woebegone children who peddled little labors in fantastic tales of grief. You'd see them in packs of 50 and sometimes even 100, skittering in mismatched shoes and muddy faces. They'd thunder up to you like a herd of wild horses. You could hear the padding of so many tiny feet. Sometimes I'd wonder where all the parents had gone, why they let their children run around like that. And then I'd catch myself. The orphans would get out of control sometimes, especially when they saw a foreigner grabbing and shoving one another, until they were scattered by one of the men with whips. They'd come out of nowhere, the whip wielders, like they'd been waiting off stage. The kids would squeal and scatter, then circle back again, grinning. If I raised a hand, they'd flinch like strays. If a war went on long enough, the men always died, and someone had to take their place. Once I found 7 boy soldiers fighting for the Northern Alliance on a hilltop in a place called Bangui. The Taliban positions were just in view, a minefield in between. The boys were wolf-like, monosyllabic, with no attention spans, eyes always darting, laughing the whole time, dark fuzz instead of beards. They wore oddly matched apparel like high-top tennis shoes and hammer-and-sickle belts, embroidered Hodge caps and Russian rifles. I tried to corner one of the boys on the hill. His face was half-wrapped in a checkered scarf that covered his mouth. Abdul Waqdud, he said his name was. All I could see were his eyes. I kept asking him how old he was, and he kept looking over at his brother. His father had been killed a year before, he said, but they fed him here, and with the money, he could take care of his whole family, $30 a month. My mother is not weeping, Abdul said. I could see how bored he was, and his friends definitely noticed because one of them started firing his Kalashnikov over our heads. That really got them going, laughing hilariously and falling over each other. Two of them started wrestling. My photographer and I calmed them down and asked them to pose in a picture with us, and they lined up and grew very grave. After that, they stood behind us in a semicircle and raised their guns, not like they were aiming at anything, but more like they were saluting. Then a couple of men appeared on a hilltop, bearing a kettle of rice, and the boys descended on it. The Taliban came down the road a few months later. I've got the boy's picture on a bookcase in my apartment. So why don't I just, I'll go through a few more of these. These are some scenes from northern Afghanistan where I, if you remember, before 9/11 happened and when 9/11 happened, Afghanistan was, the Taliban controlled about 95% of Afghanistan, but there was a tiny little piece of territory in the north that was still controlled. It was still controlled by kind of these anti-Taliban rebels. And I actually got to go there. This is a nice scene. I got to go there in 1999. This is actually sort of a father and son glass-blowing business. I mean, how many of those can you... You won't see that in a street in Philadelphia. It's actually four sisters. This is kind of the Afghan version of American Gothic. You can see... Sort of, you know, mom and dad with preemie. You know, you can't really see here, but this is a town called Talakan. It's in northern Afghanistan, very far north. Again, I was there in 1999, a long time ago. The Taliban were kind of all around the city, but this part, which kind of backed up, you know, onto the old Soviet Union, on Tajikistan, was controlled by, I'll just show you really quickly, a man named Ahmed Shah Massoud. I don't know how many of you recognize him. He looks like a French painter, as you can see. And actually, he was fluent in French. And, you know, these warlords in Afghanistan, I mean, really, they could sort of tear the limbs off of babies, and they sometimes did. He actually was a very humane man. His men always were not. But he had kind of a sense of the world outside of himself. And he was the last holdout against the Taliban. And if you remember... He was killed by al-Qaeda on September 9th, 2001, 2 days before 9/11. Al-Qaeda sort of figured, I think, correctly that the Americans were going to come looking for him. He was a very famous anti-Soviet fighter. And so they killed him first. And so I saw him in 1999. And again, the Taliban were kind of on all sides of the city. And I just want to back up to the Gothic shot. This is a really extraordinary scene. It doesn't look like... this is sort of the main street in Talakan here. And after I left, and again, this is kind of March 1999, the Taliban came into the city not very long after that. They conquered Talakan. And I didn't go back to Talakan until November of 2001 as the Taliban collapsed. And this scene here was kind of everybody. It was this joyous scene as we rode in November of 2001. Women were taking their burkas off, and men were digging up these television sets that they buried underground in these plastic bags. And music was playing, and it was this extraordinary scene on that very street. I'm kind of jumping around here. You can see Massoud had a very modern army at the time. He was more or less forgotten. That's an old captured Soviet helicopter. It was a really cool moment. It was Eid, the Muslim holiday, and all the locals had heard that the great one Massoud was in town, so they all kind of wandered down from the villages in the mountains. And you see many of them had fought against the Soviet Union themselves. This is actually Abdul Waqdud, the kid that I just read to you about, with his half-covered face on the hilltop. The Taliban were kind of just not terribly far away. I like this. You know, these kids, they can't read their own language, much less English. And, drug smuggling was about 80% of the economy, as unfortunately it is today. And so, anyway, but they were very happy to pose in the picture. Average age 14, I'd say. It's a very earnest sign. You can see, painted by some European NGO. I mean, it's kind of sad, but I'll just go through these really quickly. There's Abdul Waqdud again. You can see the landscape. It's just astonishing. This is, we're sort of getting into 2001. In my own case, I was arrested by the Taliban in 2000, a year before 9/11. And I was expelled from the country, and it was kind of a nasty little affair. But I didn't go back to Afghanistan until after 9/11. I was in New York for 9/11, and then I got sent back. And typical scene at a newspaper. I was sort of wandering around the newsroom one day in September of 2001, and one of my editors walked over to me, and he said, "Haven't you been to Afghanistan before?" So within days, I was on an airplane again, coming back. This is actually a girls' school in Massoud land, up in the north, in the part that was not held by the Taliban. One of the reasons I got expelled from Afghanistan in 2001 in 2000 was because there was, at that point, it was illegal for girls to go to school, and people were running these secret underground girls' schools, like in their basements and in their back rooms. And so I had found, I was basically checking these, I was looking at these girls' schools, and I got caught, and I got thrown out of the country. Wonderful, isn't it? They're very beautiful people, and you can see, the Silk Road kind of runs right through Afghanistan, and you can, that girl could be from Cleveland, if she probably had something more to eat. We're definitely into 2001 here. I'm gonna stop in a second. This is a cemetery, actually. This is sort of a funny shot. This doesn't look like Jean-Claude Van Damme, but the Northern Alliance, who these guys are, they're kind of getting ready to fight the Taliban. And, they weren't much of an army. I mean, they were this kind of ragtag bunch of guys. And suddenly out of the sky appeared these beautiful kind of starched and pressed uniforms in boxes in October of 2001. Of course, they were dropped by the Americans. And so suddenly these guys look like a real army. And again, we're sort of getting ready for the battle. There was a lot of waiting. If you remember, it wasn't until about a month after 9/11 that the bombing campaign started against the Taliban. So we all kind of waited. This is amazing. This is the first day of the bombing campaign in October of 2001. And I don't know how many of you have had the pleasure of seeing a 2,000-pound bomb go off, but it's not like the movies, It doesn't go bang. It shakes the earth for many, many minutes. These were B-52 strikes, and the Taliban trenches are literally just over the hill. And so I think with that, I'm just going to, if you'll indulge me, I'll just read a little bit more. It's a very short section. I have a lot of ground to cover. I always go on too long in these photos because they're so nice, Okay. I'll just read a little bit here. And again, you just look at the photos. This is from October 2001. On a clear day, you could see the B-52s overhead, their contrails marking the sky in long white streaks. They seemed to float up there, so high above, Sometimes, given their altitude, they took half an hour to traverse the whole horizon. The exhaust plumes hung in the air long after the planes had moved on, so on some afternoons the whole sky would be looped and crisscrossed, white against the blue, like a work of abstract art. It wasn't just the bombs they dropped that were so unnerving. It was the lumbering, disassociative way they let them go. One of the bombers would make an appearance, usually at 30,000 feet, a tiny gray V in the sky, all the way from Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, 3,000 miles away, gliding like a crane. Then, without warning, the sharp titanic bursts, the clouds tumbling upwards, the ground moaning as if something crucial in the world had broken off and fallen away. And then you'd look up, and there the plane would be, arcing, plodding, moving against the great blue sky. Sometimes at night, working late in the mud brick hut, I'd hear the faint whoop, 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 and I'd rush outside, and if I was lucky, I'd see a blackened silhouette against the star-flecked night, a helicopter without lights, here then gone. The Americans were here, the Afghan said, but I didn't see any of them until much later. On the morning the bombing started, the windows in my house clinked and rattled for minutes on end, like a tea service in an earthquake. I drove as fast as I could, as far as I could, forded the Kokcha River on a horse, ran crouching through the muddy Northern Alliance trenches, reached the most forward post, and peeked my head up over the top. The Taliban positions were just in view, only 300 yards away. A rolling gray, green field lay between. Up and down the Taliban trench line, the blast from the bombs had left gigantic circles of blackened grass, like the footprints of some huge beast, 50 feet wide, blackened hoof after blackened hoof, concentric and overlapping. The bombs had hit the trenches precisely, gone directly inside. And there, across the field, rose the turban head of a Taliban soldier, looking to his right, then to his left, amazed, perhaps, that he was alive. I felt sorry for those Taliban fighters. I really did, just sitting in their trenches, trapped, uncomprehending, waiting to be bombed. I was right about that, right about what they'd felt. I saw the Taliban prisoners afterwards, dirty and frightened, and all they talked about were the bombs. For the Taliban, the waiting was the worst. A B-52 would appear in the sky, drop a bomb or two, and then begin its great U-turn toward its home on Diego Garcia. The B-52s took forever to make that turn, arcing slowly and grandly, turning like an aircraft carrier. And just when I thought the B-52 was finally headed south, headed home, it would keep turning, keep circling back, and then I knew that it was coming back for another run. Sometimes it would take half an hour. And then I'd imagine the Taliban guys in their trenches, fiddling with their prayer beads, looking up, waiting. Well, we'll just blow through the Afghan war here. I could go on forever about every photo here. This is an extraordinary scene. It was the Northern Alliance, and we were outside of a city called Kunduz in northern Afghanistan, and the Taliban and a lot of al-Qaeda fighters were trapped, several thousand of them, and we thought we had a deal. We thought the Taliban had surrendered, so everybody was kind of marching in proudly. The Taliban has surrendered. The Taliban has surrendered. But it turned out that it was a double cross, and they attacked. And we almost didn't get out alive. A lot of people didn't get out alive. And that was that army that just kind of disintegrated that day. But again, there's too many photos here. I could go on and on forever. This is an amazing series of photos. You know, I don't know if you can see here, but, well, you can't. There's sort of mountains here, but if you kind of went this way, the Afghan steppe, you know, it's as flat as a pool table. For hundreds of miles, you can look and not see so much as a tree. And so James and I were kind of, you know, half asleep and very tired, and we were driving across the steppe towards Mazar-e-Sharif. And kind of like a mirage in the desert, we saw 10 trucks filled with these soldiers. They were Taliban prisoners, taken prisoner at Kunduz, several thousand of them kind of crammed into these trucks. And you can see, you know, the Afghans didn't take prisoners, you know. I think they were on their best behavior because the Americans were around. And so they let us walk up to the truck. And I remember it was just amazing. There were fighters, you know, there were sort of al-Qaeda guys here in Taliban. And they were calling out for water. And they were calling out for water in six or seven different languages, you know, Arabic, Urdu, Dari, you know, every language you could think of, Chechen. It was just incredible. And I'll just go through these very quickly. As it happened, most of these prisoners were in fact killed not long after we left and buried in the desert, not far from this place. And the graves were found a few months later. Again, it's kind of the Afghan way. You know, they just didn't take prisoners. And I'll just... see, look at the guy in the top, in the middle. I mean, he's not from Afghanistan. He's probably from the Sudan or from Egypt. Oh, God. I mean, again, I could talk forever. This is a scene from... I don't know if you remember... If you all remember John Walker Lind, the American Taliban, who was captured in Mazar-e Sharif. He's actually under... This was the big battle in the prison in Mazar-e Sharif, and there were hundreds of Taliban just mowed down by the Northern Alliance, and you can see they're just kind of looking for rings and trying their shoes on here. But underneath the ground, unbeknownst to us, as this picture was taken, there were about 100 fighters, Taliban fighters, underneath the ground, and one of them was John Walker. He came out the next day. This is a guy named a 19-year-old kid. A Saudi kid, a fighter for the Taliban who'd come hundreds of miles, named Fahd Nasir, and he was from Riyadh, and I found him in this kind of prison. He'd been shot in the arm. You can see he's kind of holding his arm here. And it's interesting. It's a wonderful photo, and you can just see by looking at it, you know, he's not the sort of knuckle-dragging, drooling zealot that you might believe most of these people are. He was just a sort of mixed-up kid. He'd been recruited. It was kind of a fool's journey. And here he was. I have to say, I remember as I walked out, I said to the guys in the Northern Alliance, I said, well, what are you going to do with him? And they kind of laughed and did this, you know. And I never found him after that. Actually, this is yours truly. I think at this point I hadn't taken a shower in about 6 months. But that's the road to Kandahar, actually. It's actually very nice for the scenery, if not for the reporter taking up the space there. This is Kabul, actually. So, you know, my book kind of travels across this kind of arc, and I spent, 2001 in Afghanistan, most of 2002, and then I'm going to ask you mentally to change gears very, very, very harshly, I fear, because we're going to Iraq in 2003. You can see here's Kuwait City. I was in Kuwait City on the first day of the war. I actually rented a car. I went to a Hertz rental car and rented a GMC Yukon and just drove in on the first day of the war. It was the dumbest thing I ever did, but this is a nice photo. Of course, the most important thing to notice in this photo is the pack of Skittles down at the bottom. There's really no photo without the Skittles. These are some Marines on the way north to Baghdad in the beginning. This was an ambush. We actually got ambushed on the way up several times. And I'm not kidding. I was with James Hill, the same guy I was with Afghanistan with. So at that point, my God, we could read each other's minds. But they were still by James Hill, these photos. They're very nice. And we're kind of making our way. This is, of course, a very famous scene, the statue being pulled down in Baghdad on April 9th, 2003. If you can, and I'll just tell you a quick story from that time. It was such an extraordinary day, April 9th, 2003, the day the regime fell, because it was kind of the day that America won the war and lost the war, and it kind of all happened in the space of just a few hours. And I remember the night before, James and I were in the rented Ford Yukon, or the GMC Yukon, and we were in a palm grove where we slept that night. And I remember we were kind of shadowing these Marines who were going in, and they hadn't gone into the city. They were going to go in the morning, and they said to us, we don't know if we're going to have any resistance. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. So James and I woke up that morning and we kind of drove in, and it was clear immediately that there would be no resistance whatsoever. I remember as we drove in, you could see the piles of Iraqi uniforms. You know, they were just taking off their uniforms, throwing them. And you know, by 8 a.m., this is a little bit out of order. This is kind of a happier time. You can see it's one of Saddam's palaces. But by 8 a.m., the looting had started. This is the central bank in Baghdad. You know, by 10 a.m., the ministries were on fire. By noon, the whole city was kind of engulfed in chaos. And it was just an unbelievable day because, I mean, here was the conquering army, you know. It went 300 miles in 19 days, cut right through the Iraqi army, marched into the city, took the government down. And then kind of all the wind went out of it, you know, in a single day. And I remember I was, later on that day, it was about 2 p.m., and I was I found myself standing in front of the offices of the Iraqi Olympic Committee, which sounds like kind of a joke, but the Olympic Committee were where one of Saddam's kind of deranged sons named Uday used to, it was kind of his personal fiefdom. And the Iraqis were just tearing it to pieces, and they were crazy odd. I mean, they were just out of their minds. Very poor people who'd come over from Sadr City, the Shiite slum, and they were carrying out stuff they didn't even know what it was, you know, pieces of computer and telephone and anything they could get their hands on, tearing it to pieces. And Uday had kept, Saddam's son, had kept these beautiful Arabian racehorses that must have been worth $500,000 each, and they were kind of rearing up. So it was almost like kind of a Dali painting, this scene, and there was, you know, the smoke plumes in the background. And I was there kind of watching this, and I noticed that standing right next to me was a 24-year-old Marine lieutenant who was looking also. And I remember I said to him, you know, these guys are very impressive. I mean, he's 24 years old. He's in command of you know, 50 guys, life or death. They'd fought all the way up. And I said, well, what are you going to do, you know? And he said, I don't have any orders, you know. And it kind of summed the day up, you know. So moving on, well, doesn't need much explanation on my part, I don't think. And again, these photos are wonderful. I could just sort of ramble on about each one of them for a long time. And I should say, you know, these are scenes from 2003, 2004, and it's very different now. Hold on, sorry. It's very different now. You know, back in October, the fall of 2003, when the insurgency really got going, you know, the Americans weren't ready for an insurgency. They weren't expecting it. And their reaction was, and they will tell you this now themselves, we're going to kill and capture all the bad guys. You know, we're going to kill and capture our way out of this thing. So they'd go into these villages and they'd sort of grab every Iraqi, you know, between the ages of 17 and 35 who didn't have a smile on his face. And, you know, there you go. And I'll tell you, if, you know, I mean, you can sympathize with them. You know, maybe a Humvee got blown up the night before. They moved into the village. The next day, the Americans did and pulled everybody out. We're going to find the bomb maker, you know. Well, they'd find the bomb maker, but, you know, if you, they'd grab 100 other people as well. And you can see by the look on his face, if he wasn't a member of the insurgency before they grabbed him, he certainly would have joined it after they did. And that's kind of what happens. Very different now. You know, the American Army and the Marines have kind of learned their way through this, and it's been very painful, and it's taken many years. But it's a completely different sort of mindset now. I mean, now instead of killing and capturing, it's our main goal is to make friends with the civilians, and even if we have to take more casualties to do that. And I think it's one of the reasons why the violence has come down so much in Iraq. We can talk about that a little bit later if you want, but it's just an amazing scene. I saw a lot of those things in 03 and 04. You know, this is a scene from a car bombing in 2003, and I should just say it's very, very frustrating as a being a newspaper reporter, particularly a newspaper reporter, maybe not a TV reporter. You've all seen it on television. 50 people were killed in a car bombing today, you know? Your eyes just glaze over, and you just move on to the next story. Yeah, another car bomb in Baghdad. If you've ever been to one of these, it is absolutely the end of the world. I mean, one car bombing. This was one car bombing in October of 2003. It was the International Committee of the Red Cross. It was right after the UN bombing. And if you just, you know, the insurgents were, whatever else they were brilliant at this. They bombed the UN, they bombed the ICRC in very rapid succession. Within a couple of weeks, there were absolutely no more aid organizations in the country. They're all gone, all left. And this just happened to be, the ICRC was right next to, just happened to be a couple hundred yards away from the New York Times house. And so I remember that morning, it was about 8:30 in the morning, and the blast went off, and our whole house, which is made out of stone, shook like a toy. And we all went running to the scene. It's pretty rough. Now, just imagine, if you can, in a city larger than Philadelphia, of course, but Baghdad is about 7 million people, thousands of these, thousands, you know. And maybe in the course of 5 years, there were 1,000 suicide bombings, probably 4,000 car bombings. 4,000 of these. Imagine what it does to a city. What it does to people. What it does to the survivors. And of course, he doesn't know what planet he's landed on. This was a kid from. He was a reservist from some town in Maine. Again, moving right along. This is all these shots are in the book. But I mean, not the photos themselves, but every photo in here is kind of a scene in the book. Actually, this photo is in the book. But if you look over to the left-hand side, you'll see a kind of faded poster of Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite cleric. This is an open-air mosque. It's called the Moksin Mosque, and this is just any old Friday afternoon. And if you go as I did, and just you could stand kind of right there in the front, and 25,000 men typically on a Friday afternoon going back for a mile. All men, of course, no women. And they would start to chant, Muqtada, Muqtada, Muqtada. And you could literally feel the waves come off the crowd. It was just amazing. Moving right along here. I don't want to go on too much longer. This is, in November of 2004 was the biggest battle of the war. When the Marines went into Fallujah, November 9th, I think, 2004, there were about 600 Americans wounded, 100 killed. I went in with a company of Marines, 150 guys, Bravo Company, the 1-8 Marines. In 8 days, at the end of 8 days, a quarter of the unit I was with was dead or wounded. It was just extraordinary. It was very, very intense. And this is kind of a moment. I went in with a photographer, Ashley Gilbertson, who's now, these are all his photos now. And this is just a moment, kind of, we were being bombarded in a house, and you can see from the photo that it looks like everybody's pretty close to losing their minds, which is pretty much what happened. Again, I think this photo shouldn't have gotten in here. I'm somehow writing next to a latrine, but just to give you a sense of what it was like. I'm just going to read you a little bit. I should just say a little bit about who's fighting the war over there. When you hang out with these guys, they're all 19 and they're not from Moorestown. They're not from Manhattan. They're not from Cambridge, Massachusetts. They're from Starkville, Mississippi and Oswatomie, Kansas, and Pearland, Texas, places you've never heard of. And they're just kids, they're just 19-year-olds. And this was actually, a quiet moment in the Battle of Fallujah. We were just in a house, and the fighting had kind of died down a little bit, and we just kind of stopped, and Ashley took some photos. Some of these guys are, for example, this is DeMarcus Ware, 22, from a place called Martinsville, Virginia. He was killed a couple of days after this photo was taken. I'm just going to read you a little bit, and then we can sort of wrap it up and go to questions. But... they're nice photos. This is the guy down in the lower right, Nathan Anderson. He was also killed just a couple of days after this was taken. This is right before the battle started. I should say, and I'll stop here and I'll read a little bit. And I have to tell you, when you hang out with these guys, it's actually kind of fun, They're all like 19, and they're just kids, And it's like you feel like you're on a high school football game, And everybody's, they're wrestling and they're fighting over their M&Ms, and only a 19-year-old can like smoke 2 packs of cigarettes and then run 10 miles and do 40 pull-ups, And that's kind of what it's like, and they have like they practically have their own language, They swear so much, it's actually kind of refreshing. Because they're very, very disciplined, in every way but that. And so I have to tell you, I'm just going to read you a couple paragraphs. And there's a little bit of profanity in it. So if you can't take profanity, I have to tell you, you can't go to Iraq. So I'll just read you a little bit, and then we can just kind of take some questions. This is what I'm going to read you is 2 years ago, in the summer of 2006, I was in Ramadi, which is the capital of Anbar province, Anbar province is kind of the size of Wyoming. It's just west of Baghdad. It's kind of the cradle of the Sunni insurgency. It was really the most violent place in Iraq for many years. It's very quiet now. But I went to Ramadi, the provincial capital, in the summer of 06, and it was unbelievable. It was like a scene of total devastation. It was like a science fiction movie. There was one building that still stood in the town. It was the government center. And the Marines were sort of holding it at all costs. And so I went to the government center, and we got attacked every day that I was there. Soldiers were getting killed every day. And it was just a very, God, it was so intense. And so this is a scene from the government center in August of 2006. And again, I apologize up front for the profanity. In the mornings, you could stand on the rooftop of the government center in downtown Ramadi and watch the Iraqis trickle into the streets far away. The cityscape was obliterated for a mile in each direction. Total ruin, like Grozny or Dresden. The Marines had given names to the blown-up buildings. Swiss Cheese, Battleship Gray. The human activity unfolded beyond that, at the outer edges of the destruction. From the top of the government center, the Iraqis seemed like tiny figures in a greater landscape, trudging to some end they did not know. By noon, the landscape would be empty again. It was a joke among the Marines posted there, the government center, since there wasn't much of either. The center of the city was obliterated, and the government had ceased to exist. There was a governor, a half-crazed man named Mamoun Sami Rashid, but most everyone else in the government was dead or in hiding. A few months before, Rashid's secretary had been beheaded. Rashid lived a weird, cloistered life, driving with the Marines, flying with the Marines, surrounded by the Marines, in the rubble of his hometown. There were two worlds at the government center, the rooftop and the interior. Unless you were going out to fight, fully loaded, the outside was off limits. The moment you stepped out of the building, you had to run. You had to run everywhere, even to your Humvee. No standing. It was the snipers. The toilets were broken, naturally, since there was no water, but you couldn't go outside for that either. There were no portalettes because the snipers would have gotten them too. You had to do your business indoors, into a small green sack called a wag bag, named for the flammable chemicals it carried in its lining. When you were done, you'd tie up the wag bag and toss it into a regular trash bag, and one of the grunts would take it out at night and set it on fire. The snipers were good. In Iraq, the insurgents might have been raggedy-ass guys who scored by rigging blasting caps to rusty artillery shells, but a number of them were former soldiers, and some of them were snipers. They carried Russian Dragunov rifles with huge scopes and long barrels. They aimed for the neck, in the soft spot between your helmet and flak jacket. The Marines, all from Kilo Company, lived inside, about 75 at a time. The place reeked, of course, of stale urine and old clothes and so many bodies pressed too close together. There weren't any showers. You showered after you came out. The urinals didn't really work, but they used them anyway, and sometimes the piss would drain through the pipe, and sometimes it would leak out on the floor and go stale. The guys slept 8 to a room, stacked together like kids in a dormitory. The rooms had windows, but most of them had been shot out and boarded up. The tours at the government center lasted 2 weeks, long enough to make anyone crazy. One Marine, David, lived by himself in a tiny crawl space on the second floor opposite the stairwell that took you up to the roof. He was from Tampa. His job was to keep the rest of the Marines supplied with water and food, which wasn't much of a job, a kind of make-work thing. He was a sort of Boo Radley character, friendly but a little slower than the others. Most of the time, David stayed inside the cubbyhole, playing violent video games. Whenever I walked past his room, I could hear the explosions. "I've never been on the roof," David said, gesturing toward the sunlight in the stairwell. "Ain't never going up there." And nobody was forcing him to. The Marines were young, and they made the most of their circumstances. They kept a weight room on the first floor, dark and sandy, and they played Metallica and pumped iron till they fell asleep, banging music and banging weights. They slept more than you would think. Generators kept the AC going, and the boarded-up windows made the rooms dark, and most of the guys would sleep right through the gun battles on the roof. The heat outside was astounding, but the guys still went out most days, loaded with gear and guns, into the night, into the rubble, looking to waste people. Sometimes when they ran, they tossed canisters that threw up green smoke. I never heard them talk about hearts and minds. We go out and kill these people, Captain Andrew Delgaudio said. He was in charge. There was a primal simplicity to being in Ramadi that made it refreshing, even in the stink of it. There were no politics to complicate things, like there were back in Baghdad. Here, people were fighting to the death. I asked Delgaudio how his men were doing. Let's see, he said. Lance Corporal Tussey, shot in the thigh. Lance Corporal Zimmerman, shot in the leg. Lance Corporal Sardinus, shrapnel, hit in the face. Corporal Wilson, shrapnel in the throat. That's all I can think of right now, the captain said. Delgaudio was 30, an Italian from Parkchester in the Bronx. Sitting there glowering in his T-shirt, he reminded me of one of those tough guys from a 1950s movie, Brando without the charm. I guess he had a right to be angry, trapped in this desert shithole and charged with killing people. I asked Delgaudio to take me out on one of the night patrols, and he told me to forget it. You'd probably step on something, he said, and blow us all the fuck up. So, I think that's about it. I've got a couple more photos. Actually, this is the last photo. I'll just leave you with this. This is the company of Marines I was with in Fallujah, the guys who had 25% casualties. And they had a memorial service for the dead, for I think the 16 dead in their unit. And they asked me and Ashley to come, so we flew down to Jacksonville, North Carolina. I mean, try finding that on a map. And, it was strange. I thought, there'll be a band and, a parade and the local TV station will be there and the newspapers. And you can't really see here, but nobody came, It was just a high school gymnasium. They didn't have to pull the other bleachers out. It was just the Marines themselves, I think. This is one of the girlfriends. With that, I'm happy to take your questions if you have any. Not sure how this is going to work. Yeah, I think you just raise your hand and then somebody will hand you a microphone. How about you? I guess I'm going to call on you.
What do you do about language, and what do other reporters do?
They do different things. It depends. I speak about 8 words of Arabic and about 8 of Pashto. But in fact, I'll tell you a funny story. It's in the book, but it's a funny story. We generally rely on these really extraordinary local people who risk their lives for us and sometimes die. The New York Times has lost 2 Iraqi reporters. You become very close to the people that you work with because, I'm risking my life, but he's risking his life, and he's generally risking it for me. I'll tell you, there's a guy, he's in the book, his name is Wazir Jaff, and he was an interpreter of mine for many years. He's a very close friend of mine now. And Jaff is an amazing guy. He looks like Clint Eastwood and very tall and sort of good-looking, and he had fought with the Kurdish guerrillas. He's a Kurd. He fought in the Peshmerga. Very brave, great guy. We were very close. And one day, he spoke perfect English, perfect Arabic, perfect Kurdish. And one day, I said to Jaff, Jaff, why don't we go talk to Sheikh Ahmed, that kind of shady character. Whose side is he on anyway? And so Jaff and I went over to see the Sheikh, and we walked in the room, and I had my little list of questions, and I sort of sat down, and I started to ask, and Jaff said, just hang on a minute. And Jaff and Sheikh Ahmed launched into this long conversation in Arabic. And, on and on and on. I had my little list of questions about, something silly like the Iraqi constitution or something. It got very heated at one point, and it went on for like 20 minutes. So finally Jaff said, okay, ask your question. And Sheikh Ahmed said, tea for my American friend. And so we had this long conversation, about the Iraqi constitution or something. And so an hour later or whatever, we were driving back, and Jaff was kind of lighting up a cigarette. And I said, Jaff, what were you guys talking about back there? And Jaff kind of laughed, and he said, well, Sheikh Ahmed wanted to kidnap you. And, he said, look, we can make a lot of money off this guy. you know, $1 million for you, $1 million for me. And you know, this entire conversation was unfolding right in front of me. Not the first time, not the last. And fortunately for me, I don't know how many, if anybody here is from Kurdistan, but Jaff is the largest tribe in Kurdistan. And Jaff's father is a prince in the Jaff tribe. And so Jaff basically said to Sheikh Ahmed, look, my tribe is way bigger than your tribe, so don't even think about it. So at which point, Sheikh Ahmed said, okay, you know, it was just an idea, sorry. So tea for my American friends, you know. There you go, you know. Kind of an improv. How about you, kind of, with the white on there?
Both Senator McCain and Senator Obama want to put more American soldiers in Afghanistan. Mm. It seems to me Russia demonstrated that you can't put enough soldiers in Afghanistan to be effective. What's your view and what should we be doing with regard to American forces in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, I'm glad I'm not taking that job. But, you know, it's amazing, though. You mentioned Soviet Union. It's extraordinary. You can, when you go there today and you drive down these old rutted roads like I was showing you here, and the overturned old rusty Soviet tanks are kind of just sitting there, you know. And it's just amazing because you can see them and you can think, my God, some guy, you know, it's 125 degrees outside, and you think, my God, some 19-year-old from Moscow, you know, met some terrible end, you know, sitting in that tank, you know, suffocating. But I was just, I was not just in Afghanistan. I was just on the Afghan border in Pakistan. And I have to say, it's much better in Iraq, but Afghanistan's much worse. And I was really struck by how much it deteriorated. And you know, the terrain there, it's like, you know, it's like the Grand Canyon. I mean, you saw the picture there. And so the idea, I think, and I don't know what the idea is, frankly, but I mean, the idea that you could have sort of a surge in Afghanistan, it might work in Baghdad, which is, you know, just a big city, but not in Afghanistan. I mean, I can't imagine. I don't know that that's what they have in mind, but I think it's very, very tough in Afghanistan right now. And I'm not a military officer, but I don't know what would work. You know, I really don't. It's very tough. How about you?
This morning in a radio interview on WHYY, I believe you said that you thought that if Barack Obama were to be elected and were to withdraw the troops within a timeline, that could be a mistake, and unless I misunderstood, but...
No, I didn't say it would be a mistake. Her question is, somebody asked me about, you know, what would happen if Obama got elected, and I'm a little skeptical. I mean, I'm just trying to be honest with you. I'm a little skeptical of, I mean, McCain's position on this is very clear. You know, we'll stay as long as we need to stay. And Obama has basically staked out this position, whereas, you know, we've kind of done all the good we can do, and we'll try to leave in 16 months. I'm totally speculating here, which is probably not a good idea, but I'd be surprised if he carried through with that, because I think if he wins, he'll come to office, and I think he'll be confronted with a very, very different situation on the ground now. I mean, I was just there. The violence is way, way down. It's remarkable. It's very fragile. It may not last, but it's changed. And I think his generals, I'm sure, will make a pretty good case not to pull out too rapidly. He still may do it. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, how long America stays in Iraq or Afghanistan or any of these places is not going to be determined by conditions there. It's going to be determined by conditions here. If people don't want to stay, we're not going to stay. But conditions in Iraq have changed pretty dramatically since he made his kind of 16-month pronouncement. So it wouldn't surprise me if he modified his position somewhat if he were elected. How about you? I think you raised your hand before here. And then I'll come to the back.
How would you interpret Charlie Wilson's assistance in Afghanistan to the Mujahideen?
And it's a great movie.
What do you think about it?
I don't know that time very well. I really don't. I mean, I do know this, which I tried to get into a little bit in the photos when I showed them to you, but I just... You know, I think today when people say, you know, as bleak as the situation in Afghanistan now is, and it's, I think it's pretty dire at the moment, I think when people say, look, why don't we just leave? just forget about it, pack up and go. Well, that's kind of, we did that. You know, we did that once before, and, you know, any of you have seen the movie, it makes very, very clear, you know, we helped drive the Russians out in the 1980s. We pumped the place full of guns and money, and we kind of, you know, the Pakistanis, we put them in charge, and they gave all the guns to all the wrong people. But and then we walked away, and then you got, you know, this kind of terrible sort of situation metastasized into this, you know, we got Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And I think, I mean, if you just take right now, you know, there is a lot of concern. I mean, if you had an American intelligence person here, you know, there's a pretty pervasive belief in, say, the CIA and in the American intelligence agencies that Al-Qaeda has basically reconstituted itself. The leadership has inside Pakistan in the tribal areas there. There have been six, some successful, some not, terrorist plots. The 7/7 bombing in 2005 in London have been traced back to the tribal areas. And so I think, I don't think this was your question, but I think that if you ask yourself, you know, why have we not left, you know, why don't we just leave, I'd say go back to Charlie Wilson's war. If you remember right at the end of the movie, you know, when all the reports started flooding in that, oh, my God, you know, we're walking away from that place and it's going to hell. You know, maybe it would again. How about you in the back?
Thank you. A comment and a question. I would say there's a profound eloquence to your journalism. And secondly, it's quite exemplary, your courage. and I think it's quite commendable that you're doing the job that you are doing and conveying it back to us as Americans. One question I was discussing with my daughter, she wants to be a journalist also. How is the amount of money that we're putting into that war stabilizing with our infrastructure here today is going on? You know, like our country's pretty much in economic turmoil, and the money that we expend, we're not necessarily bringing back. What would you say, would, in your view, would be the priority of where our funds should be spent, you know, as taxpaying Americans?
I'm sorry, our priority...
In spending, you know, should we continue to put more money there, or should
a political decision. I mean, I think, again, as I tried to say when I answered her question, and the other one, you know, maybe we'll just walk away. I don't know. I mean, but I think there'll be consequences if we do. I mean, maybe we can't afford it anymore, you know, and maybe these things were misconceived and it's too late and we walk away. We're not going to be able to not pay attention to them. I mean, I think they'll come back and bite us if we do that. But, you know, we may very well find out, you know. How about a couple more? Okay, how about you, and then I'll come back to you.
The name of the book is Endless War.
The Forever War.
Forever.
No, I think these wars will end. I don't know when they'll end, but this book is, it's a very visceral book. It's a book about kind of what it feels like, and you know, for me, it's already been forever. I mean, it's been 10 years already. You know, I mean, look at Iraq. I mean, it's 5.5 years, $1 trillion, and probably 100,000 dead. Afghanistan, we're at year 7, and it's tougher than ever. Feels like forever. I think there was a hand back there. Yes, you.
Thank you. This is a question about journalism, I guess. When I think of this war, for how long it's gone on...
Which one is that?
The one... Okay. but Iraq in particular... there's really, in the context of the Times, which maybe like a lot of people here, you know, I try to look at every day, there's two names that come to mind, which would be your name and John Burns' name. And I know there's other people. I know I'm sort of simplifying it. But say with Vietnam, there were many, many names that would have been attached to the reporting. Yeah. And I'm kind of curious, how is it that you have been there as long as you had? Was this a case of you constantly re-upping? Were there? Could you talk a little bit about the assignment process?
That's a good question. No, I mean I stayed too long. You know, I mean I just I be you know I was sort of you know smoking crack or something. But I mean, really, it's a lot like, I mean, I've never done crack cocaine, but I imagine it's very intense when you're there. You kind of feel more alive. Every decision you make is very important. Everything is life or death. You can get hooked on that pretty easily. But to answer your question, it's remarkable if you take a place like the New York Times, how many people don't want to go. These are reporters. These are people who you would think, you know, my God, they're waiting their whole life for this. And, you know, they go down the list and kind of the people who want to go, they don't want to send, and the people they want to send don't want to go. And so it basically, you know, it comes down to this kind of, you know, little intersection of two sets. So, but I think, actually, I'll answer your question another way, which is, I wish my friend John Burns were here. I don't know how many of you have seen him on the Lehrer NewsHour. He's much more articulate than I am. He has this kind of booming Victorian accent and big hair, and he's a lot of fun. But I think what's changed is that when I went into Baghdad in April of 2003, there were probably 3,000 reporters there, you know, all over the place. Now, there's probably 25, you know, almost nobody. Almost everybody's gone. And the reason for that has been basically security. You know, it's been almost 200 reporters killed there. I mean, as I said, we lost two. I mean, if I just take the New York Times, my God, you should see, I don't have a picture here of the bureau, but it looks like a medieval castle. I mean, we have belt-fed machine guns on the roof. We have 20-foot-high blast walls, you know, checkpoints, razor wire, 45 armed guards, armored cars. It's crazy. It's insane. And we're like, we're trying to talk to people, you know. So that's really, really expensive. The Times spends millions of dollars on that thing every year, and there's just not that many people who can afford to do that. So please renew your subscription to the New York Times. Anyway, but I mean, the short answer is, so if you there's no European papers there left, almost at all gone, you know. You know, no French, there may be a couple British, no German, no, nothing's gone, you know. So it's strange, you know. And anyway, long answer. How about one more? Oh, okay, two more. Okay, you and then one more. You. I don't know. I mean, we're just trying to protect ourselves. Well, it was pretty bad there a couple of years ago. Yeah. It's a lot better now. Yeah. I mean, the facts have changed on the ground. And maybe I sound like a spokesman for the Bush administration at the moment, but if the facts on the ground have changed, I think we're obliged to recognize it. And they have changed. The violence in a place like Anbar province, where I was in Ramadi, in 2006, the violence is down 90%. I mean, when I was there a couple of weeks ago, and the Americans are walking around without helmets on, you know, without guns, without flak jackets. It's different. It may be very fragile. It might go to hell. It may not be worth it, but it's different. It's changed. Okay, last question. How about hand over there? Okay.
You definitely had a heartfelt a kind of response to the young people, young soldiers that you interacted with. How do you think we should prepare young people? I'm a high school teacher, and there were Marine recruiters in our cafeteria talking to our football players today. I was given a pamphlet in case I wanted to bring it into the classroom.
I don't think you can prepare anybody for that. I'll tell you a quick story. It's actually towards the end of the book, but when I was in Ramadi, in the government center, I spent one night on the roof, kind of standing post with this 19-year-old kid from Georgia, and he had a really heavy accent. You know, I could barely understand him. And great kid though. And you know, I remember he had four guns laid out in front of him, and we were kind of looking out on this kind of ocean of ruin. But you know, it was 120 degrees at 2 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, we just talked for a couple hours. He's a very nice kid. And I remember when I got back to the States, I kind of wondered what happened to him. I kind of wondered what happened to so many people that I met. But for some reason, he stuck on my mind, and I looked up his house. I found his home in Georgia, and I called his mother. And I called his house thinking he might be there. I just wanted to check up on him. His mother answered the phone. And she said, no, he's, you know, deployed again with the Marines. He's on a ship, you know, and they for 6 months or something. And so I said, how's your son? And she said, well, you know, this is a Marine. You know, this is a 19-year-old Marine. He's a tough guy. He's killed people, you know. She said, well, you know, he came home, and his nightmares were so terrible that for the first 6 weeks I slept in bed with him. You know, I'm his mother. And then she got all embarrassed and said, God, you probably think I'm crazy, you know. But she said it was so terrible. He's my son, and I had to watch him sweat these terrible things through his system. So I don't – that's the answer, you know. I think that's your answer. She's going to haunt these kids forever, you know. No, I think that's it. I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.